Thanks for leaving here. Not the next people around because my friend in the other section hasn't obeyed orders and hasn't brought back their papers in time. I have for you this article. And I think in contrast to what we have been doing here, this may supplement very well, round out your picture of the problems of an historian. So I want you to read this and write a paper on it. The month of May, so that I may have a sample of May 20th. This is quite off the beaten track. 20 years ago, there was a symposium, what is it, 20 years ago, I think, there was a symposium in London held about historical problems in general. And this contribution is by an Italian historian, Mr. Momigliano, who had to leave Italy when Mussolini was raging mad in the Hitler days of Mussolini, when he already had lost his brain, really. Because there are two Mussolinis, you must obviously, one intelligent one in the first half and one broken man in the second. And he, Momigliano, lived in Buenos Aires, as far as I know. He's now back in Italy. And he has done something unique. He has put before any student of history what, as he calls it, an unsolved problem of historical forgery, without solving it himself, but only showing the situation. And so it's like a quiz or like a puzzle, and showing you the intricacies of our dealing with genuine or false sources. And I think this introduction, since you never will get hold of it, published in an English publication of the Warburg Institute in London, I thought I should make it accessible even on the Pacific coast. Although you are, of course, far out of reach of civilization. And I have all told, I think, 12 copies. Now there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, that. But my friends in the other section, just as I told you, haven't been very good about it. They were expected to give it back to me yesterday. So I make an attempt to appear. And you will have to give this back to me because it's quite precious. It cost me $26 to have it made. So I spent a lot of money for you. And if they don't come around, I still think they will. You will have to share this. Every one of you will have to share with this opposite number here, you see? So look. Look at it. Yes?
Will you?
Yes. That's your opposite number. So you here, you, this will go here, this will go here, this will go here. Over here, and then you too.
Something passing on?
Yes, you too. You will be here. You have one, have
no,
you?
No, they didn't.
Oh, yes, they've got to cross here. One copy himself, mm-hmm. Right? Sure. So she's privileged
on this side of the house. Mm-hmm. No, one of you must pass one on.
Yeah,
well,
no, it's all right. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 copies. We're only 12 people.
Oh, I thought you wanted to just look at them now.
Oh, no, no. This is to May 20.
No, I know that.
I shall receive the paper. No, at this moment, you put it aside. And we won't go into this now because that would just be a waste of time. Perhaps you make some... Yes, you, I want to tell you and give your own conclusion what you think of this situation. Now, the interest may, I may have to say one more thing. It deals with our main source on the history of the 3rd century AD. Now, the 3rd century of AD, on the one hand side, is the most important one because it is the time at which the Roman Empire succumbs to the necessity of going Christian. At the end of the 3rd century, Constantine becomes a Christian and capitulates and moves his capital from Rome to Constantinople, which is the biggest event of ancient history. You see, he says, the ancient gods of my city of Rome, you see, will pursue me as a Christian. I have to leave and have to leave it to the Bishop of Rome, you see, the Pope later, to cope with Jupiter Capitolinus and Juno on the Capitoline Hill. Now, this greatest exodus, of course, it is never celebrated in your historical tradition, that it isn't the Christianizing, the baptism of the emperor, but his exodus, you see, imitates, of course, the exodus of Moses from Egypt. It is the exodus from the false gods of Egypt, you see, to a new city. And it should always be taught in this way, it is. And I think all your textbooks leave you, therefore, in the dark. For the world, gentlemen, in the history of the world, the exodus from Rome to Constantinople is the only, the event of the crucifixion arrived. That is, it took 300 years before what had happened on Golgotha made epoch in the history of the visible world. Before, it was just invisible, lived in the basement of the history, so to speak, in the catacombs. So this is why I think to cope with this document is just more than coping with some historical documents. The third century is the darkest of centuries because we only have this source of which we do not know how much it is genuine, how much it is just a rhetorical forgery in honor of Constantine, the great Christian emperor, who is now already, you see, putting the finishing touch, so to speak, on the victory of the Christian church. The Historia Augusta, how is it called? You read it out the text. It means, you see, it is the collection of writers on the third century dedicated to Constantine officially to show that he was inevitable, so to speak, to show that the empire couldn't go on like that. So it is our only document purposely written as a history of the third century. We have fragments of other historians, of course, we have inscriptions, we have coins, but we have no history. And this has something to do with our attempt now to dabble with ancient history, because it must make you sit up and think, what is antiquity? And antiquity is still a time in which time can be dissipated and break down. The later times and periods of antiquity are less known than the time of Thucydides. That's an incredible fact. That is, the people in the last 300 years of antiquity, just as perhaps the government of Montezuma in Mexico was one of terror, horror, human sacrifice, cruelty, and agonizing dissipation and complete disintegration. Now, it's opposite from your idea of progress. You think history must be a straight line. That isn't true. People have just as many times gone back on what they have known, you see, and forgotten. As you know, it was known 250 BC that the earth rotated around the sun. It was totally forgotten 100 years later and remained forgotten for another 1500 years. And don't believe that it isn't possible that this happens again. The idea of progress is stultifying your brain. History doesn't go in this way at all. And this third century is therefore, as it is, one of the darkest, one of the most instructive things of history, because something very great came out of it. The first time that an empire survived its own gods. Can you take this down? You see it in China, how brutal such a survival of one's own god is. In 1911, the last Chinese emperor, you see, he was deposed. Ever since, China has been in turmoil, and you speak of communism and Mao, don't be betrayed. I mean, the breakup of China is a story of the next 300 years. And nothing what happens now is very important. Don't read the papers with such exaggerated interest. These are all momentary things. Developments, if an empire like China with 600 million people has to give up its pagan script, which they are doing now, its gods, because these were hieroglyphs, as in Egypt of old, you see, these 40,000 literary bricks, as the Egyptians did when they got Christian centuries. He breaks down its timbers and gives up its whole literature, which they would have to because they take up now all Latin script. That cuts very deep. And you can't be surprised that this leads to an incredible change and transformation. And if you study the third century, you may get a picture of what is going on in China now and how long it will take them to achieve this. They are giving up their gods. They are giving up their history of 3,000-4,000 years. And so don't think that this can be these slogans, communism or socialism or whatever it was, is of what they don't care. They want to get out of something. What they get into is a web, you see, they can't help. Now, I mention this because you may compare 1911 to something like the year 300 in Roman history. And if you read the history of the 19th century in China, you know what a terrible story it is. Boxer. In 1900, the Opium War against the British, and nothing, so to speak, counts. It's just a situation. No, all the efforts made in every decade of Chinese history, the 19th century, can be entitled too late, you see, or too early. Too late as far as the empire goes, you see, the purely Chinese solution, and too early for any integration into the industrial world of the West. So nobody can be successful, so to speak. Now this is part of the story of the third century. It is too early to go Christian and to give up the Roman gods, you see, and it is too late to try to restore Roman piety. The best emperor the Romans had is the last pagan emperor, Diocletian, and he governs, as you may know, from 284 to 308, and he is known only for the Diocletian persecution during the history books. But there's a law in history, which I like to mention to you, that never is a bad ruler the cause for a great revolution. Because revolutions are not made for people, for individuals, you see, but for a misrule in the bones, in the structure of a government. So Louis XV, who was a bad king, did not lead to the revolution, because people said perhaps a better king can still cope with the problem of the French constitution. But when Louis XVI came, who was a good king, then that's the bad. The same with James I. James I was drunken every day. So they didn't make a revolution because they said it has to be by perhaps just the fault of King James I in England. But when Charles I, who was a nice king, had to do the same tyrannical thing, they said something is rotten in the state of things, and beheaded him. One of your illusions is, you see, since you are such moral people, is that wickedness leads to revolutions. The Tsar of Russia in 1917 was a very nice person and meaning well. That's why he had to be murdered, because the constitution of Russia was impossible, you see, and not the Tsar. The King George III, as you well know now, was a very decent chap, but the independence of this country was right for quite inner reasons, you see. So whatever they did, even when they took back the Stamp Act, you see, it didn't work. It happened. After all, the parliament in Britain was very reconciliatory. They revoked the Stamp Act, you see, but it didn't work. Will you kindly then take down? Revolutions have nothing to do with individual wickedness, because people will always forbear an individual's wickedness, hoping that the next will prove better. You didn't overthrow this government because of Mr. Harding. He certainly was an unscrupulous man, and Mr. Grant's misrule was just horrid in the 70 following years, you see. Then you wait till you elect another president. So wickedness in high places
as it is called, you see, is not a reason for revolutionary change. Now that is against all your moralizing stories in the Little Red Schoolhouse. Since you are all taught by women teachers, you all get a wrong impression of history. History has nothing to do with morality. History is efficiency. And the individual can be very well rejected and forborne, you see, as an exception. But when, after the exception, you see, has shown out and the rule proves to be impossible, something has to be done. So Christianity came after the best emperor of the Roman Empire had proved a failure, and not the worst. Diocletian is a very great ruler. And he was so wise that he even, as you may not know, survived his nephew's Constantine's Christianization. He simply retired to the famous palace in Spalatin and split and planted his chard and his cabbage and said, "Empire, not for me anymore." They called him back one time and asked him to come back, and for heaven's sake, help. He said, "Sorry, I'm only interested in my own God now." So God favored him. You may say that the mercy of God was on Diocletian, the last persecutor of Christianity, because he had no ambition of his own. And so he was spared, and as a human being, as in the flesh, so to speak, carnally, he was not the victim of this transition. But Rome had to be given up, the city of Rome. And at that very moment, the empire ended the history of God with men instead of remaining under his private God, so to speak, under Romulus and Jupiter Capitolinus. All these things have completely slipped your minds. For the last 50 years, people have been told about the Roman gods as though there were no gods, and the Christian gods certainly, although God, Christ wasn't God. But if Christ is not divine, certainly the history of the world can absolutely not be told. The divinity of Christ is in the fact that 300 years after his crucifixion, he rose from the dead and moved the emperor of Rome to Constantinople. What is it? Did you come in? Well, this is not a good place to stay. Well, this has all to do with my attempt to arouse your interest in the 3rd century of our era. It's the most, the darkest, the most obscure, the most misjudged. And 100 years ago, if you went to college in this country, it would always have been taught that Constantine was the receipt for Pontius Pilate. You see, that the Romans, 300 years later, knew better than what they had done in Jerusalem. Today, as you all concentrate on the so-called life of Jesus, which cannot be written and which doesn't exist, and you are completely unable to understand history. Because without the Christian era, history, there is no universal history. There aren't only the history of China or the history of Japan, you see. All pagan history is disconnected. The only attempt to get into a world history has been made by the people who wrote the Bible, who prophesied that there would be one history of mankind, and the Christian who did it. And otherwise there is no, there's just no history. I have a friend who is a pagan, and he was very true to his paganism. He composed the world history in 5 big volumes in German. Hans Helmholtz is his name. One is Europe, the second is America, the third is Australia, the fourth is Africa, and the fifth is Asia. Now, you look at the Australian volume and you can imagine how thin it is. You see, there's just no Australian history. But nevertheless, he was at least true to his paganism. In paganism, space comes before time. And in Christianity, time comes before space. If you take down this rule, you will look through all the paganism that is rampant around you, which disconnects the times because it falls for spaces. All the American history which you learn today is pagan history, because every attempt has been made in the last 40 years to dissociate America and give it a special place as though it was a historical entity of its own. Whereas obviously it goes from independence to interdependence. For in 1776 it can only be explained as a revolt against Britain, and now it can only be explained as a pivot around which the world is integrated into one global system. And if you omit this, you falsify everything. This country, after all, is peopled by immigrants. They are no Native Americans, except the poor Indians. You are not Americans, you are people who have come to America. Therefore, America is on the run. It's a dynamic force. It is, has been used as a bridge, to bridge over the differences between the various continents. As soon as you take today of a nationalistic American history, you try to become an ancient pagan again. And this is, of course, the Renaissance mood in all people's minds. The great heresy today, you see. You read Plato, you read Aristotle, and you read into your American history something in space, something local. It's all rampant. This whole university is riddled with this paganism, of course. And what does it mean? That space dominates time. That's Mr. Einstein's doctrine, that time is the fourth dimension of space. Therefore, time can be neglected. You first take a square, say, call this America, and then say, I write the history into this. Therefore, you find nothing that points beyond or before this space, you see. The space is then not the crystallization of time, as Constantinople is the result of the Roman Empire becoming Christian, you see. But you look at the map and say, Byzantium lied in such a wonderful position that, of course, it had to become one day the capital of the world. But the force that drew the Romans into Byzantium, you see, is simply omitted. It's all geography. You find this in all your textbooks today. And you have to decide, everybody has this decision every day to make. Is space dominant of time, or is time dominant of space? If you move your house, you see, then time is dominant of space. You decide where to live. If, however, you inherit an old farmhouse and have a white elephant on your hands, and I know a boy, he was a boy from New York. The only thing that connected him with his past was his heirloom of a white elephant. His father, who was a big bank president in New York, had rebuilt, because he came from this farming community. His father committed suicide. He was left all alone, no mother, no father, no relatives. He was an adopted child, by the way. He lives now in this little house, in this little village in upper New York State. He is married to the town's belle of the town. She's there, Edith. And he was so homesick that he had to find somebody. This girl has completely emasculated him. He's not allowed to go to New York. He wanted to go to Norway, establish a business there. He's wealthy. She is a poor girl, a foreman there of the factory. But she has stripped him of all his locks, like Dalila, the Samson, because she insists that he has to stay in Granville, New York. Because that's all she knows. She is a country girl, she's frightened by the big city, she couldn't stand up with anybody, she couldn't hold her own. And this boy, at the ripe age of 25, we had to give him up. He was my student. And one of my colleagues, we were very close to him, we have seen him go down and go down because the space nightmare, you see, that he has to live in Granville, New York, where he doesn't belong at all, has destroyed him. Generation of wipers. And so I see this all the time going on in this country now. The lure of mere space, you see. It is the same as the mother complex, of course. Similar, you see, the womb. Because the womb is also something, you see, not you choose and you decide for, but you go back into. It's the same story. And as you know, this problem is very much with, if you say at this age of yours, I have to live in Southern California, you can hardly have any life. You can't, don't have to say, I must leave Southern California, but you must be free to say sometime, you see, I don't know. As soon as a person decides that it is a certain place where he has to live, you see, he loses another part of his freedom. In 1935, when the Oxford Group movement came about, I met a number of interesting people in this connection. And one was Mr. Musselman from Pennsylvania. And I tell you this story because I think it has very much to do with our being historical disease today. He said, I come from the deathbed of my father. My father was a Mennonite minister in Pennsylvania, so am I. So my father knew that he was going to die and called me in and said, my son, we came to this country 300 years ago because we didn't want to take arms. We are peaceful people. And because the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire demanded from his subjects that they were ready to serve and, you see, to be put into the army, we left and came to America. Now I'm afraid I look around and I feel, well, after the First World War, before the Second, that we may have conscription in this country. So you have to promise me that you will keep the congregation fit so that if this calamity should occur, we can leave again. Now, my contemporary, my friend, the son, said to me mournfully, my father didn't consider our quandary that now there is no place to go to. You could go to America, you see, 300 years ago. But what do we do today? And so we are so space-ridden today that you live already as though space could contain you. And that's why you have to make a special study of the conditions of human freedom today, because if you cannot emigrate, if the passport can be taken away from you by your state of consciousness, then you are licked indeed. Then you are just cogs on the wheel. The free movement over, you see, to decide in which country to live is the great privilege of everybody who lives in this country, because in his ancestry he has this one exodus of Constantine to Constantinople. Every one of your parents, grandparents or so, sometime made a decision to come to this country. And I think one of the problems of the Negro question in the South is that the Negroes did not make this decision. They were kidnapped and brought here, you see. So there isn't this great event in their lives that at one time in the family history, you see, they said, we go. You understand? And if you could find for the colored people in this country such a decision, the whole integration problem would look different. But they have never in their strain of blood, you see, made this spiritual decision that time comes before space, that you create the next space yourself. All the important questions of the Negro problem are never mentioned in this country. It's a very strange situation. Right? Volumes and you have Supreme Court decisions, but what is really about, nobody ever cares to know. It seems that you don't want to know. One is that everybody else in this country came here not as a slave, you see, or at least 9/10. There have been, of course, servants, the indentured servants, but that's such a small group, and it could be amalgamated with the rest. So will you kindly read this paper with some interest in the historical problem itself. If you can penetrate into the darkness of the third century, then you understand the eternal problem of history to move out of a given space into the next. Today this is so difficult because you have to move out of America as a mere nation or as a mere self-contained, isolated continent, into its becoming a part of the universe. This is a spiritual movement which doesn't consist in your giving up the space here, you see, but looking at it in a new light, you see, as being part of the globe. You understand the difference? This is a new spiritual emigration, which is much more difficult to perform because if you take a ticket, so to speak, your legs are informed that you are moving, you see. But mere thought will not do this. That's why I'm still advocating a worldwide service, because if you do not move into Vietnam or China or Tibet, you see, for definite, or Africa, you see, the globe will not become a reality to you. Today, the decision has to be made in every generation. Some people put space before time, their homeland, before that which is due at this moment, like the South in 1860, in order to defend states' rights, you see, they neglected the hour which even the Tsar of Russia heard in his ear when he emancipated the serfs. You see, the Tsar emancipated the serfs before the southern gentlemen decided to do that. You know when the Tsar emancipated the serfs?
1861.
Before Mr. Lincoln.
That's very important.
He just followed the Russian example. And then again, you see what paganism does. This is not in the American textbooks in connection with the Civil War. Just not mentioned. You speak of Alaska because that space that was bought in 1867. But gentlemen, what you bought from Russia is the example of the emancipation of the slaves. And you got it for nothing. That's not in any textbook.
It's somewhere mentioned by us in a footnote, but not under the real spiritual pressure of the atmosphere of your daily newspapers.
How can you read in a paper that the Tsar has set the serfs free, you see, in 1861, without this working upstream in this country? I think all American history at this moment is absolutely polluted. The people who wrote the history in 1870 give you a much better picture of the American Civil War than the people who write on it today. Because America has lost its faith in the unity of world history. It's now trying to have a nice, peppy national history. In a time when all other nations have to give up their national pride. And so I think all history books written at this as of the last 20 years are lacking in faith and in perspective. And there you have a good example of backsliding. Take the educational system. Since 1910, America has not made progress in the educational system, but regress. Now, you have to understand that nobody is the sure of progress. The more you say progress is automatic, the more you may be sure that it is, that you go backward. Progress is a constant uphill fight. And the tragedy of this great country is that since 1910, when William James died and Theodore Roosevelt went out, this country has lost its soul to pragmatism, as you well know. And pragmatism means there is no continuity. It all comes by itself, automatic. Nobody has ever before believed in automatic progress. But you are made to believe this. So what happens is that you move in a vicious circle today, and the issues are just endless because nothing is ever solved. Imagine that since 1914 this mighty republic has not been able to conclude peace. Do you think the treaty with Japan is a peace treaty? Do they have anything to eat? Do they have anything to live? This may be in paragraphs written, but that's not a peace. Because we haven't given them a place in, you see, no trade with China. Obviously, the only peace treaty we can give the Japanese is to give them a certain area within which they can trade. One of the ridiculous phrases, the Treaty of Versailles, is this a peace treaty? With Germany, we said peace is declared. Oh, that's not a way of making peace. With the Russians, we are at Cold War. For 40 years, this country has struggled desperately not to make peace. And it has succeeded. And this comes all from the idea that America can, so to speak, can hold off and you go places. I mean, the Haiti statehood, Hawaii statehood, and the Alaska statehood shows you the unimportant steps that are taken by the Congress. It's very nice that Hawaii and the Alaska states will never be. This is a pipe dream. It's very nice to have two more stars, but they are not states in the original sense of statehood. You, with 35,000 people in Alaska and white people, you cannot, that's not a state. It's just a nice occupation for the Congress and the aunts and the daughters who write the letters there. I mean, Congress gets that superfluous thing at this point. Because the great solutions are too difficult. I mean, that would tell the people that hard times are ahead and not prosperity. So the poor president has to haggle over $3 billion of foreign aid. I mean, then it should be 15. Because we are in a global situation. We are not in a local situation. It has all to do with the sermons on history which you hear in your schools. You see, if you dance around the flag, then of course the two more stars in the flag are the important thing. But if America is a star-spangled banner, it's inviting all the nations of the world to join the open sky of our real creator, you see, then this story is very different, you see. Then it isn't the two more states of Hawaii and Alaska, you see, that matter, but whether the other states would also feel stars, to be stars in one galaxy with us. And that is the promise of America. All this can be told about the year 300. So, May 20th, may I have this paper on your, what you think. And it, as you see, it has great implications whether you say this is written at the end of such a critical era when Rome was given up, or whether you think it's a belated forgery of people who had really no political standing. Did you get a machine?
Yes.
Well, after the recess, then we should do this. We plunged into Thucydides, didn't we? Did you find that there's anything about the men in the book? Who is Mr. Thucydides?
What is this true? Did you use a little word? is the stumbling block. What we call history has been determined by Mr. Thucydides. He's the first historian. Herodotus has been called the father of history, but I think Thucydides is the first brother of modern historians, the oldest. What we call history has been determined by Thucydides. That's quite a strange thing. What our departments of history now proclaim is Thucydidean history. And so he is more than a historian. He is the historian, the yardstick of history. Yeah?
He's been called the father of scientific history.
Yeah. We come to this, sure. It's the Greek aspect of history. It's the anti-Jewish aspect, and we have lived on two strands for everything we speak today or we think today. You see, always the Greek and the Jewish, the Israelite. Israel is perhaps better because only that it has the spiritual connotation of a different language, of a different approach. The Israelites are indifferent to space, and the Greeks are given to space.
That if for the Greeks the history is predetermined by the people who carried out, by the Israelites, it is the epoch
which is determined, you see.
At one time God sends Israel, at one time the Egypt has been relinquished, at one time the great flood comes. So it is always the Israelites have to do with the epochs of the world, with the eons of eons, with the ages of ages. The Greeks have to do with the fate and destiny of cities, of the individual entity, of the body politic and its history. So everything I have said against American history had, of course, its protagonist in Thucydides. You have to look through these two eternal strands of our human thinking. Christianity is an attempt to not allow one or the other to get the upper hand. It is the synthesis of these two. There is an American history, of course, as a part of the universal history.
The Old Testament doesn't write such an interesting story as Thucydides about the individual, you see, story of the... it's not interesting. That goes by. But the Greeks are. So Thucydides is the father of scientific history. That's point one about him. When did he live? Will you tell me?
455 B.C. to 400 B.C. according to the...
Well, is it known?
No, I said according to this book, it was just an estimated time.
Well, there's great uncertainty about his life, as a matter of fact. But what is the outstanding event which makes him, so to speak, authorizes him to write the history of this? What was his position?
Well, from the reading, he was a general.
Yes, but on the basis of what?
On the basis of his wealth and citizenship. On the basis of his wealth and citizenship.
I think wealth, yes, he was. And it has even been a suspicion that he was not simply an Athenian, but may have been mixed in with the Thracians, with Thracian origin, that he was, so to speak, half a native of a non-Greek country, which I think adds zest, because first generation people, and I really cared to think, of course, very much being one, you see, an immigrant, are the best. Because they make the greatest effort. So Thucydides had every reason to make a real effort to prove his Athenian value. He had to do more than the ordinary. So, he was like a 49er in California. He owned gold mines, you see, in Thracia. And where is this, his home? Where is it? Could you show it to me on the map?
I think I can show it on the map. Yes, I have that on the map. But I can tell you, what was there a map there? I'm not looking in the book. I guess the closest it could possibly be, no, it is. There's still Macedonia here. Yeah, I noticed here it is. No, it isn't either. It's the right of Macedonia.
Yes.
To the east.
East to the east. On the way to Constantinople. Well, there is in... I asked you to look up the places in which he is mentioned.
Places in the book, yeah.
Did you find his own participation in the war?
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me? What did he do? I think it's a very significant... way of mentioning his own actions. Can you tell me?
Well, I just remember that in Thrace he was supposed to...
A little louder, everybody wants to hear.
In Thrace he was supposed to go there as general to, I can't remember the names right now, to fight off this Spartan general, but he came too late, or the day after the Spartan general had taken over Amphipolis or something like that. Yeah. And then he was put into exile after this
book.
For 20 years.
Put into exile, that's not good English. How do you say that?
Sent into exile.
He was exiled. always try to keep the verb the verb. And don't use these circumlocutions, will you? This is horrid. This is the death of language. That's really always the end, when you have to kill the power of the verb. This country is riddled with noun-mindedness, you see. So the language becomes brick. I mean this, you see, usually the language as consisting of bricks out of which you build houses and mental pictures, as you even call it. And as soon as you treat language as visibility, it dies. Language, nouns are subordinate to verbs. We speak because we have to describe our place with regard to an act, you see. Language means, which you do not know, now again there's this complete pagan teaching about language in this country at this moment. You see, I can say, I shall be exiled. I am to be going to be exiled, you see. I am exiled. And the three tenses describe your position towards an act. Language is not the power to say I am exiled or I am green, you see. But it's the power to place myself with regard to the time of another event. Therefore, the three tenses are pre-given. We speak in order to be able to say what is behind us and what is in front of us, because we have to live. Our living means, you see, to leave something behind in time and to go forward, to decide what is dead and what is living. That's why we speak. And therefore, if you can't say, you see, I'm exiled, you have misabusing language, as our schoolmasters do abuse it today, by saying, we want to say that this is a book. We don't speak in order to think or claim that this is a book. This you can throw on the table and everybody sees what it is, you see. For this purpose we don't speak. But we have to say, I'm through with Europe, you see. I'm all for Asia. In this moment you decide what's the future and what's the past. That's why we speak. So all the tenses of grammar are simultaneously given. We speak this was because we want to be able to say this shall be. Because we have, otherwise we are suffocated as a lack of oxygen when we dive into the water. You see, life is full of corpses. Every human being at every moment has to breathe freshly and has to bury his dead. And we speak in order to decide what we have to leave behind and what we is coming and what we are in. So the three tenses of grammar give you the skeleton of speech, you see. Have been, is, shall be. And you have to decide where you are at this moment, you see. What you decide, my parents, that's the past. My wife, that's the future, my children. If you can't do this, as most Americans can't, they can't speak. That's why most boys here can't get married. They have mistresses and mothers. Because they never can say that they have to leave their father and their mother and cleave to the wife of their choosing. That's why we speak. The marriage vow is a good example. That means a break in time. And from this moment on, your father's home is behind you, is the past. And your home that you are going to build is the future. And that's why we have to speak. Any oath you take, see, is such a decision from now on. This is alive, and this is dead. You come to this country, here as an immigrant, you take an oath to become a citizen of the United States, you forswear allegiance to all the past gods, you see, to the emperors and kings of Europe, you see, and you become a citizen of the American. For this you have to speak. Because it is only speech is made to mention breaks in time. That's why history is a natural with human beings. You see, we are historical beings, because we have, otherwise we will be killed by the masks of the dead. You could never leave Europe, never become an American citizen, you could never marry, if you couldn't say this has been and this is not. So I want you to understand that to speak historically is the first breath of life for a human being by which makes that we are able to transform the world, whereas all the animals have to stay put and remain where they are. An animal cannot say, has been. You see, we can. And all you learn about speech, or what a lesson it could be, is all wrong. Because today in this country, people undertake to tell you, this is a newspaper, this is a book, this is an envelope, this is a chair, and they call this language. For this, nobody would care to create language. But you have to create language in order to say, you see, one thing has been and the other thing is to come. Because you have to date your life. You have to emerge. So this is Sukirida's attempt to show that he is an Athenian. And I think now, could you give me the chapter in which he speaks of this? Of this event, I think it deserves some scrutiny. Where is it? Where is Euclidus, lady?
On the fourth row.
Oh, I'm
the fourth row somewhere.
Well, I think it deserves scrutiny how he puts his own engagement and his own participation. I think it's very subtle. What is subtle about it? What did he
say? Page 290, I think it's the page about the gold mine.
288.
Now, by the way, which chapter is it?
288, chapter 8.
May I say that this is one of the most horrid translations that exists, which you have. Mm-hmm. It's only cheap, but in every respect. Which chapter?
I have 290 for my page.
Yeah.
I don't mean the pages.
Chapter 8.
Book 4, chapter 8.
It's about the fourth paragraph, according to this translation. Well, you can find where the armistice is. I mean, I think Athens is far ahead of Sparta. It's more than just before now. It enumerates the
404. My paragraph. Now, I have here an old stodgy translation by the greatest British translator of the 19th century, Mr. Jewett, who was mere master of Bailey. You may have heard his name, yes. Translated Plato too. He was Jewett, M.A., master of Bailey College, Regius Professor of Greek at the University of Oxford. It came out in Boston too, and it's infinitely more trustworthy than this translation, which is made readable and thereby a force to simply go off from the truth. Let me read then my text. The opponent, it is, no, where is it? Your paragraph. The passage of the river was a complete surprise. Against some people is now brother and led his army. Yes. Allow me then to bore you with the text, just as a case of historical analysis, so to speak, of text analysis. Against Amphipolis, brother does now led his army. Starting from Arna and Chalcedon, towards evening he reached Aulon on Promiscus. Do you have this?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worth your while to compare how it is in the two translators' corners. At the point he reached Aulon on Promiscus, at the point where the Lake Bolbe flows into the sea, having there supped, he marched on during the night. The weather was wintry and somewhat snowy. I make a pass over this, and we go now
over to the next paragraph. The general whose care the place had been committed by the Athenians sent for help to the other general in Chalki, Thucydides, the son of Olorus. Now Olorus, as I told you, is not a great name, who wrote this history. He was then at Thasos, an island colonized from Paros, and distant from Amphipolis about half a day's sail. Half a day's sail, I would suspect, means 12 hours. I'm not sure. But it's an interesting question whether a day is 12 hours or 24 hours at that time. I'm afraid that the 24-hour day didn't exist. And it could well be that it's just 6 hours. It's quite interesting, you see. For the human beings, day and night are clearly divided. That we speak of day as 24 hours is a result of the last 400 years only, you see. And of the abstract reckoning of modern mathematics and physics.
Very late.
The daily laborer is a man who works from daylight, sunrise to sunset. And that's what we mean by a day, you see. A day's work and all these things. I think it's quite interesting. I don't know what they say in the Greek text. I didn't bring it. As soon as he heard the tidings, he sailed quickly to Amphipolis with 7 ships which happened to be on the spot. He wanted to get into Amphipolis if possible before it could capitulate, or at any rate to occupy Ion. Where's Ion? You have a map? Is it near Amphipolis?
Yes, it's right.
Is it further out to the sea?
Yes.
It's, so to speak, the harbor of Amphipolis, is it?
Like
Piraeus.
Like the Piraeus on Athens, yes. Meanwhile, Brasidas, fearing the arrival of the ships from Thasos and hearing that Thucydides had the right of working gold mines in the neighboring district of Trachne, and was consequently one of the leading men of the country, did his utmost to get possession of the city before his arrival. Now, there you have the subtlety. The tragedy of Amphipolis, you see, is now laid to the great respect which Brasidas held for Thucydides. So, the failure of Thucydides to dispute this, you see, to come to the rescue of Amphipolis, is here turned into a merit of Thucydides, because he instilled Brasidas with such respect for his importance. I think this is the crown. If you understand this, this is clever indeed. It may even be true. We don't know. But it certainly shows that Thucydides turned a very awkward situation, you see, in his favor, because he said, explain now the victory of Brasidas with the respect for Thucydides. You see, this I think is the subtlety of the performance. Without saying a word, without telling that he's interested in Thucydides at all, it's all put at the doorstep, you see, of Mr. Brasidas, fearing the arrival of the ships from Thasos, you see, and hearing that Thucydides was one of the leading men of the country, did his utmost to get possession of the city before his arrival. He was afraid that if Thucydides once came, the people of Amphipolis would no longer be disposed to surrender. You understand the whole logic of this? Their hope would be that he would bring in allies, you see. Such an important man, he could bring in allies by sea from the islands, or collect troops in Thrace and relieve them. He therefore offered moderate terms, proclaiming that any Amphipolitan or Athenian might either remain in the city, very mild conditions indeed, and have the enjoyment of economy on terms of equality, or if he preferred, might depart, taking his goods with him within 5 days. It seems to me that since this is the only place in which he is shown as engaged in the history which he writes, you should give a certain importance to this one and only case. And at the end of the paragraph, after the surrender, then he says, Thucydides says of himself, on the evening of the same day, Thucydides and his ship sailed into Ion, but not until Brasidas had taken possession of Amphipolis, missing Ion only by a night. For if the ships had not come to the rescue with all speed, the place would have been in his hands on the next morning. Thucydides is now put Ion in a state of defense, desiring to provide not only against any immediate attempt of Brasidas, but also against future danger. He receives the fugitives who had chosen to quit Amphipolis according to the agreement and wish to come into Ion. Brasidas suddenly sailed to Ion, hoping that he might take the point which runs out from the wall and thereby command the entrance to the harbor. At the same time, he made an attack by land, but in both these attempts he was foiled. There, hereupon, he returned and took measures for the settlement of Amphipolis. The Edonian town of Nersinus joined him, and you don't have to go into this. The Athenians were seriously alarmed. Now, what is said about the fate of Thucydides?
Book 5, chapter 3.
Will you read this now in your text?
The sentence, or there's a whole
word? All about the fugitive.
Alright. The history of this period has also been written by the same Thucydides, an Athenian, keeping to the order of events as they happened by summers and winters, down to the time when the Spartans and their allies put an end to the empire of Athens and occupied the long walls and Piraeus. By then the war had lasted altogether 27 years, and it would certainly be an error of judgment to consider the interval of the agreement as anything else except a long period of war. One has only to look at the facts to see that it is hardly possible to use the word peace of a situation in which neither side gave back or received what had been promised. And apart from this, there were breaches of the treaty on both sides in connection with the Metinian and the Epidaurian Wars, and in other respects too. The allies in the Thracian area continued hostile as before, and the Boeotians were in a state of truce which had to be renewed every 10 days. So if one puts together the first 10 years' war, the uneasy truce with which followed it, and a subsequent war, one will find, reckoning by summers and winters, that my estimate of the number of years is correct within a few days. Also that, for those who put their faith in oracles, here is one solitary instance of their having been proved accurate. I myself remember that all the time from the beginning to the end of the war, it was being put about by many people that the war would last for thrice 9 years. I lived through the whole...
How many years would this be?
39.
Thrice
27 years. I lived through the whole of it, being of an age to understand what was happening, and I put my mind to the subject so as to get an accurate view of it. It happened, too, that I was banished from my country for 20 years after my command at Amphipolis. I saw what was being done on both sides, particularly the Peloponnesian side, because of my exile, and this leisure gave me rather exceptional facilities for looking into things. I shall now, therefore, go on to describe the disputes that took place after the 10 years' war, the breach of the treaty, and the warfare which came afterwards.
This is the heart of the book, of the whole work of the period of this chapter. And it is strangely interwoven with personal faith and his real concern. His concern is which? What does he, against whom does he argue? And I may tell you one thing. It's the only place in which there is even the slightest hint of any religious interest of the Thucydides. Religious in the sense of mentioning an oracle which was given there about the war beforehand, you see. Some connection with the priestly or Templar traditions or judgments on the matter. Otherwise, Thucydides, as being a scientific historian, is absolutely secular. I mean, it's just a question of cause and effect and of reason, and he is really a Greek. But he has this one great concern. What does he want to prove? What does he want to prove? Yeah.
It's one continuous war.
Yeah.
Is it one continuous
war? That is one continuous war.
And this is his stroke of genius. It's his inspiration. The Greeks are the nation of geniuses, gentlemen. Every Greek is, so to speak, whom we mentioned today, whether it's Aeschylus or whether it's Prometheus or whether it's some of Demosthenes, we worship the Greeks as a nation of geniuses. Now, a genius is able to hold on to a specific inspiration, the poem. That's an inspiration, you see. Later, he may be very stupid, this man, like Abraham, or he may be a little more insane, you see. Or he may go up the spirit like Melville before his death. Inspiration is, in regard to history, the opposite from what the prophets or the Bible tries to do. The Bible insists on the continuity of the history of creation. All his creation is one breath of God. 1,000 years are before him as one day. The Greeks say the opposite. They say, I don't know anything of what has gone on before. So Socrates begins and says, we know very little of the past. But this event, I shall stamp with the inspiration of my genius as the outstanding event of all time, and he made it so. And if he reads Thucydides, we actually believe him that the events from 431 to 404 are the Peloponnesian War. And he has made you believe this, as far as you are interested in Greek history at all. And this isn't true. From the purely skeptical point of view, you could just as well hold that in the year 423, peace was established for 9 years. This is the so-called Peace of Archidamus. And so he has here this one, you see, that's his great enemy. The possibility that somebody denies his vision. That men should look at the times here. I put them, the dates there, the 3 times 9, my dear men, as being one. Now, in order to make you understand what importance this can have for the decisions of mankind, I am, you see, engaged in a profound battle with the pagans at this moment, by who tried to say that World War II is a war by itself, fought against Mr. Hitler, and that World War I is something different. And I insist that there was an armistice between, just as Thucydides, you see, and my, you may say, I don't claim a great originality, but the inspiration which guides me in my historical attempts is to prove that 1914 to 1935 must be considered a unity if we want to understand what we should do about it. You see, I've given an address on January 30th in Germany to this, that was the program, so to speak, which I developed there before a group of influential business people, and I try to show them why, if we do not make this effort to see Mr. Wilson and Mr. Roosevelt as one, you see, having one and the same problem to solve, we will never understand that the World War II was not accidental, just the brute Hitler, but that it did answer vaccination to bring back the virulence of a poison that's in your body, you see, and to make it virulent again and so that you can operate on the patient. You know, when you have had the diphtheria, and the consequences are with you, there are doctors now. The doctor who treated Lenin, for example, had the idea, the first man who operated on the brain, Mr. Förster, that you should bring back the old infectious disease which had become latent, you see, in order to be able to cure it. You have a disease, you see, it becomes chronic, it weakens you constantly, but it isn't, there's no fever anymore, you see, it doesn't work actually. So he had the idea he would vaccinate the patient with the same poison so that he could treat it. Then he would get the diphtheria poison, so to speak, or the scarlet poison, or whatever it was, out of your body. This is the problem of the historian. The things latent, the things not mentioned, the things inarticulate, you see. And the first effort is, since you live day by the daily news, you are inclined to think that one ear is disconnected from the other. And therefore you do not see that we are paying the penalty for Versailles today, for the Treaty of Versailles, and the Americans marching out on the Treaty of Versailles. That's why we have the Cold War, because we have not learned to make peace. An historian has just published a book, The Art of Making Peace, and shown how it has came quickly and gone by default after Mr. Grant demanded unconditional surrender at Vicksburg in 1864, it was, I think, or 1863. You see, this formula has poisoned all international relations, because Mr. Roosevelt had learned in school, you see, that Grant asked for unconditional surrender at Vicksburg. Now, you can ask within in a civil war, you can ask for unconditional surrender, because allegedly you know where to go back to, you see. But you cannot ask for unconditional surrender and have no terms for the peace. You see, that's no solution. That's what we have done. Unconditional surrender is one of the most stupid formulas, because it has lulled to sleep, not as a to ask it from the enemy is all right, but it dispenses, you see, on the side of the Allies with all mental effort to understand the future and to write a just and adequate peace. And so it blinds the victor himself. It makes him, it paralyzes him. Oh, you're a slave. Well, we have dealt with the Red Indians in this manner, you see. And but you can't deal with the half of the world in this manner. So the day we have this chapter of the Kiddush, you should learn it by heart. It is the power of great genius to make you understand an effort, the unity of an effort. And that's the creation of the human spirit, that's an act of faith. Nietzsche, the German philosopher who is there still with us to plague us for the rest of our lives, I can assure you, said history will always be an article of faith. Now, you understand, this has nothing to do with any special creed of faith. It means that you can only write coherent history if you bank on the unity of an event. You create this one. You can always also tear it apart. You can say that 1970, when the United States entered the World War I, you see, that's a new event, that's the American War. And you can distort thereby the whole picture and cut it, the World War I even, into little pieces and say that the first 3 years is the European War and the second, last year, is the World War. Obviously, it would make no sense. I think it's a little more complicated. You cannot separate America's entrance into the World War from the previous events. You understand? Still in your country, I think, and I read the books right, the attempt is always made to begin the history of the World War One for America, at least with the entrance in the war, which is not true. You see, if you want to understand the America's contribution to the World War, I will remind you of two dates. And again, it's Russia and the United States who share the laurels of the event. Only to show you that epochs are inspired inside, acts of faith. We had this 1861, emancipation of the serfs in Russia, and 1860, when is it? In America?
Right.
Now, look at these two dates. In 1914, the Russians make war. And they have no other way out. I mean, it was a question of already they were the source of their own revolution for the last 9 years. So the government there simply couldn't go back down, because they had to at least have external successes, since they had only defeats at home. At this moment, Mr. Henry Ford of this country gave his workmen the $5 debt. That is, he solved for all practical purposes the cleavage between capital and labor, and declared that his workmen were his customers, which is an absolutely, you see, new idea, and which made the sorry for the solidarity of capital and labor. Because if the workman is himself the customer and can have buy a Ford car, Mr. Ford is just as much interested in the wealth of the worker, you see, as in his exploitation. In 1917, the Russians make a social revolution, and America enters the war. And you have this exact reciprocity. The Americans have first served their labor problem, and then gone to war to impart it to the rest of the states, their
their possibilities, their industrial system. And the Russians had no industrial system, of course, so they first fought the war, you see, and then are forced to give up the war and do something different, and just like what they are doing ever since. That's why Russia is really peace-loving, because it has paid the penalty of, you see, being having to go to war and then finding that the world didn't work. War didn't work. Now, you again, nobody in this country has the imagination, strangely enough. They look at the events day by day to see that when America did this in 1914, that Henry Ford acted for the United States was much more important in this moment than President and Congress and anybody else. He changed the system of the United States, the social system. And you know how it is expressed? We even have a great symbol of this. We have Labor Day. In all other countries, including this country down to 1914, Labor Day was May 1st, and it was a day exclusively of labor, of the proletariat. It was invented in this country in 1889, May 1st, and it has now become the national holiday of the Russians. It is celebrated in Paris, it is celebrated in Berlin, it is celebrated in Rome. But in this country, it was quietly moved to Labor Day in September, because it is not a class day. With the reserve of Mr. Henry Ford in 1914, you see, the whole idea that it would be an action of protest on the part of the workers against the existing order had broken down. And you know all about Labor Day and work in this country. There is no day of opposition. It's one of the grandest histories of the world, but the Americans don't care to write it up. The dislodgement of the revolutionary May 1st and its replacing it by Labor Day in September means that capital and labor in this country are reconciled. That's all what it means, but that's quite a difference. And therefore, the Americans went to war with a good conscience to export an article of faith, and the Russians went to war in order to start their own revolution. I can tell you that the leading Russian Bolshevik in Europe, a man who was shot then in Munich in 1919 when he headed the government in Bavaria for a while, went into the barracks of Munich in 1914, and when he found that the Bavarian farmers were not at all eager to go to war in July of 14, he said, "What? You do not want to have us to abolish Garden?" He was so revolutionized himself, you see, that he thought these poor Bavarian peasants and farmers had to be very keen to abolish Garden in Russia. Of course they weren't. But he thought this was the great global event, you see. The war was fought for the abolition of Russia's despotism. Only to show you in the universal engagement of men's hearts and minds in this struggle, you see. This is a true story. And it shows you that wars are always fought for spiritual goods. They are never fought for these, what you read in the books, for economic purposes. And so rather, because you can't get people to be shot dead, you know, on the ground for somebody else getting rich. See you tonight?
Yes.
See you. So let's have a break here. It means that genius has always to perform in every generation a task. People live through events and call it happening. This happened. Now happenings have to be transformed into events. Because we run through so many things, they may happen to us, but they remain haphazard. The Peloponnesian War is not a haphazard thanks to stupidity in our minds. It's a necessary event. And this has not yet been done for the last 40 years, I assure you. And this is why we are in bad shape. As soon as the stamp of inevitability, of necessity, can be put on these last 40 years, the home of this Trojan War has been found, and then the Trojan War can come to rest. And every event has to be made into an event by this act of faith that we cannot have lived in vain. This temperance, this death cannot be died in vain. The Gettysburg Address and the second inaugural of Lincoln have done exactly this to the Civil War, you see. Then it became an event that had its meaning, and near happening, Fort Sumter, so this is all meaningless. It could have been wrong to go out, you see, and have a call of arms after Fort Sumter was taken. Why not abide by it? I told you, perhaps, that on Monday, December 8th, 1941, my students in class argued that we didn't have to go to war against Japan. They said, Pearl Harbor, we just refused to accept that.
That's not war.
24 hours after the event.
Now, will you, Barney?
It is incredible that scientists will deny that they know anything of the future. Well, they know certainly that there shall be science. That's dogmatic. And then these same scientists write about dogma. That they have a very peculiar dogma. They say science comes first. Science is important. Science is necessary. Everything has to be sacrificed for science. Isn't this dogmatic? And isn't this absolutely stemming from the future? Because science is very imperfect as of this moment. And only if it is later making progress is it the real science. Many things in medicine today, for example, I believe that in my mind, I'm mere superstitious. Well, we keep going in medicine because we hope tomorrow there will be the true medicine. Though it is, of course, with every field of human endeavor. Now, if you could see that the scientists are nothing but the branch of the human prophecy turned towards the earth, and everything, the things of matter, you would understand that we all, you in this moment living here at UCLA, are preparing for the future. What keeps you here is a firm faith that it's worthwhile studying here and preparing yourself for the rest of your life. And as soon as you would give up this idea of preparation, you would become a very unpleasant hangover. You would become a student who could never leave this place, you see. And there are such individuals, but I think they are. Everybody feels they have just missed the boat. Yet, according to your philosophy of time, if you go to the logical semanticists in this college, you see, and listen to their philosophy, time, future doesn't exist. Nobody is here except as of the moment. Every one of you is here because he has quite a firm conviction that for the next 50 years he should be equipped here. So you know much more of the future than you care to admit. Everybody who is alive is drawn by the future. And you remember what he said in the first half of this meeting, that the pressure from the future is the agent that makes us try to say of those things that are past have been. I told you that all human speech, all human articulation is this attempt to get your elbows in working in both ways, moving in time, but not moving in space. The scientist who deals only with space and who tells you that time should be treated in the laboratory as the first dimension of space, at the same time, of course, is ambitious and wants to progress, and he believes only in time, and he has nothing to do with space in his own personal career, you see. He is called from one country to another, like Mr. von Braun, who goes from Germany to Florida, and it doesn't matter, you see. He wants to execute his great dream of the future. So where's space with it? He's only making this progress from year to year to come nearer to the realization of his dream. That's an historical process. And so I think all scientists themselves are just blind to what they really live. They are all, the life of the scientist today is the outstanding example of an historical example of an historical existence which is dictated to, which is articulated by the future, and therefore takes a profound interest in the
preparatory steps already done in this regard by people in the past. Any scientist is engaged in dealing with the history of his science, because he has to select all those data which are still there, so to speak, unfinished in bioformer exploration. I remember the simple story that in 1938, Mr. Otto Hahn in Germany, the father of the atom bomb, of the atom fission, published his results, I mean, that uranium could be cut into half. And they had no idea at that time that there would ever be a bomb made out of it. But Mr. Kameny, Enrico Kameny, the man who is in this country now, had made the experiments leading Mr. Hahn to this statement 4 years ago, and he didn't know what he had done. It was Mr. Hahn's business then to go over the record and to interpret these experiments, and they might have been done 50 years before, and say, this is it. And only to tell you that people in the history of science don't know what they are doing, why they are doing it. That the reinterpretation of such an experiment is very often due to an overman. And you find this time and again in mathematics. Who is, has anybody special interest in mathematics? You? Well, you may have heard of the
what is it called in English? Quaternio
in the theory of Mr. Grassmann. He made this discovery and his statement in 1849, if I'm right, or 1846. And he was so disgusted with the people of his time, no mathematician understanding what he had done, that he went off into Sanskrit and wrote then an equally elegant and important volume on Sanskrit Hindu culture for the last 30 years of his life. He just gave up mathematics and became a reasonable man. And then 50 years later, the mathematicians discovered that this was the next step, you see, in the study of higher equations. And Mr. Grassmann all of a sudden became a terribly important stepping stone, you see, for the new theory. This is how science rediscovers the past concept. And if you would understand that this is just an example as how you have to rediscover World War I at this moment, you see, as the cradle of all the problems besetting us as of this moment, you would understand why I'm long waiting for Mr. Thucydides as of today, you see. A man who makes all the school children see that they have to live after the last 40 years and cannot go back to the orange groves and the wild western films of 1900. And as long as you go to the westerners, you see, without relating these westerners as a mere past to your real present problems, you live in a dream world. Because there is not this intermission, there is not this break with the past. I think our Western movies are an excellent example of this desperate attempt of any group of people, you see, to hold on to something that does no longer exist, you see. And it's all right. I mean, fairy tales are all right. But you must know that they are fairy tales. As soon as you say these are fairy tales, you see, it's all right. But as long as you take the sheriff there and the cowpuncher too seriously, all our young boys will shoot each other if they do. And I think this is a dream world
for most youngsters. And you should measure
Sunday school and school instruction, both, by the power they have to break up the dream world of the youngster. If they enter this dream world and support it, even entertain it, and don't make them into authority beings, they have this, their time. Religion and history have this, make this attempt to make us aware, shoot us into this decision, this decided point that we decide at what time we live. Now, is there still, you care to listen to the rest? Or don't you? Then we should go. So may I add my criticism? I want you to understand, I haven't given back these papers, I would have to have been quite violent.
this whole list, past, present, future, you have to throw out as a curse of this naturalistic position that people write these three things in this pattern. Try to always write future first, past second, and then see that the conflict between the two, that's the problem. Look at your own life. You live as a child at home and in school under the routine. You fall in love. That breaks. Brings a break. All of a sudden, you have to use subterfuge to stay away from home. You have to begin a life of your own. You can't tell everything. There are secrets. And there should be secrets, by the way. You shouldn't tell them if such a thing happens. It is a secret. It's your own life. And you cannot explain it to anybody else. If it is worth it. Now this little seed, which it is, you see, the more the seed is in the ground, the more hidden it is. It has to grow. And all of a sudden, you develop a tension. And you have to let the seed grow as the old tree from which you are, a chip that has to die off in your, inside yourself, has to disappear. You have to be able to give less and less to the authority of your elders and to give trust more and more to them. That takes time. And it takes 10 years before you stay married. If you overdo it, you go ill. And if you make an artificial break, where you should make a transition, where you shouldn't. You have no present. You just have the future, you see, as an urge, and you have the past as a fact. The present, that is the process during which we are absolved and redeemed from the past and are made ready for the future. So the present is all the time a process of, how do you call this? Abwickeln in German. Liquidation, you may say. I mean, you see, you have a firm that's already, you know you want to close down, you see, the old firm. You want to establish your old firm, a new one, you see. There's a process of transition in which you have to liquidate the old firm and prepare and register for the new. That's by and large what the present is. It's a constant involvement. Here you are in college, you are still partly living on the scholarship or on your parents or on some sideline income, you see. You are preparing and at the same time you are liquidating links with the past. You are still in school, but it's a high school. We call university or higher school of learning an institution which is definitely not simply an annex of the customs of the past, which was also, as I try to say, contains some germs which the older people did not receive into their community. The university and the school are distinguished by this one fact, that the school tries to transmit what the parents also know, the three R's, you see, and the university tries to transmit you certain things which your parents have not known. That's the difference between high and low. All this is unknown, and therefore the present has this very strange connotation with you. In nature there is no present. You must always think that in nature, while I'm speaking here physically, you see, the second half of my word, which I haven't yet, of the sentence I haven't finished yet, is part of the future, and the first half which I already have pronounced is past. And there is no present. And would you kindly keep this in mind? All the natural scientists borrow from us, the historians, the theologians, the religionists, the faithful people, the notion of the present. Or any scientist who talks to you of the present as a scientific fact lies. It's always an act of faith, but never is the present in existence, except on faith. You believe that you are between your parents and your grandchildren. But that's all. It isn't in you as a power of the future now working into you. Your grandparents are represented, as we say, represented. Representation is by you only taken to be a local representative. You elect a representative and send him to Washington. You see, that's your representative.
But my dear people, the present is the meeting ground of the future in which you believe and the past which you have experienced, or which has left its mark on you. And therefore, throw out the word present as often as you can. Scrutinize. Use it not, then you will only find where this is legitimate. And you read all these gentlemen, Laplace, Euler, Einstein, Planck, I mean all the great physicists, they all bandy around this word present as though it had any right to it. You see, because they need it, of course, for their scientific studies, for the laboratories. But that's an act of faith given them by the community. We believe that they should have a day in court because we believe in their future vision, you see. We create the present. And I give you a fact that may help you or may not, may complicate matters, I don't know. The word present, of course, comes from the religious faith of the presence of God, that God is omnipresent. Present is always connected with the divine,
with the superior spirit.
Whereas past and future in a mechanical sense, you see, come from physical observation.
Would be too long a story to explain to you how the physicists stole this word future from religion. That's the sideline.
But the main point is never allow your atheistic, agnostic colleagues in the science department to use the word present as though they had any meaning within their mouths, unless they admit that they have it as faithful laymen, as citizens of the community, as members of the human family, but not as scientists. The scientist has no right to use the term present because it doesn't exist in any of his experiments. You can never have a present when you look at things in a laboratory. They are only past and future. Can you see this? I would even call it their future just an elongated past, because it's pre-calculated, and they say that goes on for another 60 minutes, or it takes 3 days, I won't go into this. But my main point is this, as a practical thing of you, I think you will emerge from this smog, which today is not in so much in Southern California as it is in the minds of men. They can only sell you science as a religion, because they have stolen this word present, of to which they have no right and claim. Where is there any present in their scientific picture of the world? Everything is rushing on. It's just a mere mild stream, you see, of constant change. Here we meet, and they meet in their lectures in a good spirit of peace, of friendliness, of presence of the one spirit, you see. And that's an act of faith. I can hear we meet for 2 hours, and this is one person, is it not? That's a miracle. That's a creation of the human family. It has nothing to do with nature. Not a natural event that I can go on if you allow me to talk here, you see.
Well, good, yes.
Oh.